Yes, sir. Thank you. Good morning. I have taken an opportunity to discuss with Mr. Conway timing.
Yes.
Given where we're at with experts, my thinking is that we may get on tomorrow.
Yes.
Date, otherwise Friday.
Yes.
Given that I do have four experts that are seeking to present via AVL, but one of those can be in Hamilton next week.
Right.
He is available in person next week. So my proposal, Your Honour, if you're agreeable, is to perhaps dispense of presenting legal subs in the interest of getting the three AVL experts through. And then
well, we have your submissions in writing, don't we?
We do.
And so we can read those ahead of time. So it may well be that what we could do would be see if we have anything in particular we want to ask you about arising from your written submissions, but then reserve for you an opportunity, perhaps at the conclusion of the evidence you call for an opportunity to say anything you wish to say.
Oh, yes, sir, that would
In oral submissions.
Yes.
Would that be
That would be very useful, sir, in the interest of time.
Yes, very good.
Thank you, sir.
Your Honour, could I clarify which three witnesses would be going first?
Yes, it would be Miss MacArthur, Dr. Corkery, and Dr. Bradshaw.
Who was the second one, sorry?
Dr. Corkery.
Oh, thank you.
We may just investigate what options there could be for remote witness presentation in Hamilton. We're not in a court setting, which means we can't use the VMR, but we might just see what we can do. I am conscious that, I may draw a distinction between the needs of having the evidence heard rather than opportunities for remote participation. You know, I'm just thinking that through, and we might come back to it tomorrow.
Thank you.
Anything else anyone wants to raise? No. I'll just check with the witness. Is there any issue about an acknowledgement? Any counsel, any issue? You recall the oath that you took yesterday in relation to telling the truth?
Right.
And you understand that you're still on that same oath now giving evidence today?
Right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honour. Good morning. Members of the court, I had a thought in the middle of the night that it might be useful to set out in a table form the various parties' positions on setbacks, which I've asked the Madam Registrar, and if I could please ask that one be given to the witness. For those online, Miss Edwards has emailed that to you, so you should have that, and I think I've handed out one to people here. If you don't have one, let us know. Just checking that the court has a copy.
Is that this table?
Yes, thank you.
We've got two documents, so the FFNZ and BNLNZ understanding of parties' positions, and you've got a Schedule C extract, that's a separate matter.
Yeah, so two documents. And just to be clear, the Schedule C page, that's just quotes from the PC1 provisions, and then the bottom definitions, WRP, is from the regional plan, and I'll come to that. I just thought it was helpful to have it all in place for the purpose of these questions. Just checking, Scott, have you had a chance to look at these? I appreciate you've only just got it.
Could you just clarify for me, DG?
The Director General of
Regulations, thank you.
So I'll work you through it just to make sure you're clear and everyone's clear. So named lakes, so you're aware of what the named lakes are. 10 metres, 20 metres and 20 metres. The unnamed lakes, the proposal is 3 metres, and then my client's position, as we discussed yesterday for other areas, 3 metres average, 1 metre minimum. And then if you look down in footnote 3, everywhere with footnote 3 in my client's proposal is subject to certification by a certified farm planner. The named wetlands, everyone's agreed that's 10 metres, so those are the ones in the regional plan that are named, so that's agreed. Unnamed wetlands, so this is the setback and also the size issue, so the 500 square metres or the 50 square metres issue, so that's in that column. The permanent stream, I think we discussed yesterday. The intermittent stream, you'll see there, and the reason for doing this is I'll come on to that. There's a distinction in everyone else's provisions between an intermittent stream and a drain with different setbacks. The further up, my client's proposal is to effectively combine those two types of water bodies and have one setback, and I'll come back to that. So that's why it's combined. So do you understand that? So it saves having a debate, which I'll come to again, whether it's a drain or an intermittent stream. And then the ephemeral stream is proposed to be no setbacks. The Director General wishes a setback, and then the springs. And then the note there, again, we discussed yesterday, my client's proposed setbacks are all subject to the stock exclusion regulations. So again, we discussed it yesterday. So if the stock exclusion regulations require a greater setback, then that would apply irrespective.
Well, legally, presumably.
Yeah.
Oh, no, because the regulations have an exception for what's in the plan, don't they?
Well, they plan to be more stringent, as I understand.
More stringent, right. So that's just really a regulation.
That's a matter of law. It's just a help. I just didn't want any parties or the witness to think that we're trying to undermine the regulations, because it's not entirely clear from the rules. So.
No.
Yeah.
Thank
you.
Thank you.
Okay, so with that in mind, do you agree that it will be important for farmers and the regional council consent and compliance team to clearly understand the different types of watercourses?
Yes.
And especially the difference between intermittent streams and drains and ephemeral streams.
Yeah.
Permanent streams reasonably straightforward.
Yes.
To identify, much harder to identify intermittent streams, drains and ephemeral streams, correct?
Yes.
Can I ask you then to turn to Mr. Cameron's evidence? So this is 304, so this is the first one in volume 304. So tab 1, 304. And if I can ask you to go to paragraph 73 of his evidence, so that's 304.0023. So you'll see at the top of the page, Mr. Cameron says they fenced all the permanent drains and some of the intermittent drains, calculates fenced nearly 4 kilometres of drains, and they've got another 9 kilometres of unfenced intermittent drains. And then you'll see he goes on when he talks about drains, he talks about watercourses, and then he says, while us farmers might refer to something as drain, I understand the council might likely consider it to be modified watercourse or stream. You see that?
Yes.
Okay. Can I then take you to the second document with the colours in it? So this is the Schedule C extracts. So this is a set of the, it's just cut and paste onto one page from the Council's proposed wording. So we don't agree with the distances, etc., but it's just helpful to have it all on one page. And so you'll see there... that the water bodies needs to be excluded from water bodies, so that's clause 5, any permanently or intermittently flowing river or artificial watercourse. And then later down it's got, for the purposes of clause 5, an intermittently flowing water or artificial watercourse is one which is not permanently flowing, is not an ephemeral water body, it meets at least 3 of those criteria.
Yes.
And I think you mentioned some of those criteria yesterday in answer to... Or maybe, sorry, maybe it's Dr. Scarsbrook mentioned it yesterday in response to this. Yeah, yes. And then you'll see the definition of drain in PC1 means an artificially created open channel designed to lower the water table and reduce surface flood risk, does not include a modified straighted natural water course. And then you see the definition of modified water course. An artificial or modified channel that may or may not be on the original watercourse alignment, which has a natural channel at its headwaters.
Yes.
How easy do you think it would be for a farmer to go on their land and identify, using those definitions, which classification of water body any particular stream is.
Yeah, I would expect that as a result of this there would be guidance notes and something similar to this that sets out the different definitions all in one place in a maybe a state level. So it was it could be worked through from different levels of people with different levels of understanding. Yeah. At the moment, as it's written, and you have to go and search for it, it's very difficult to one, find it, and then work out the differences. So I understand the challenges that there will be.
Yeah, so again, if you can go back to Mr. Cameron's evidence and turn over the next page, he's got some photos.
Can you just confirm the page, please?
Sorry, 304-0024, so it's page 23. So you see, he's got some photos of what he refers to as drains. So that's photograph 7, photograph 8, drain, photograph 9, a drain. And then he says that at photograph 10 is an example of a drain with no substantial water course. See that in photograph 10?
Yeah.
Photograph 11, surface drain that I think, so this is on page 26, that I think is an ephemeral water body. And then photograph 12, surface drain that I think it was an ephemeral water body. Photograph 13, photograph 14, and photograph 15 are all examples of what Mr. Cameron has explained to us of various types of drains on his property, that he's entirely unclear about which category they fall into. From a practical implementation perspective, do you agree that the definitions in the plan, leaving aside the implementation guidance, should be as clear as possible?
Yes.
And that ideally somebody should be able to pick up that document and look at it and be able to understand as clearly as possible, as clearly as practicable, what type of stream or water course is a it is.
Yeah, agree. My rider would be in these cases often a picture paints 1,000 words, so that's why I think guidance is really important. To supplement what needs to be written into a rule, and rules sometimes have to be written in certain ways, which I've understood as I go through processes like this, even though often how a rule is written is not how a farmer would read it, or how I would read it as a consultant.
Well, what do you think photograph 14 would be?
I would need to work through the rules to work out what that would be.
Okay, well, you've got the photograph there. I've got the rules, the definitions are all in one place on that page. So are you able to have a quick stab at it, or would you need to go and have a think about it?
I would want to have a discussion with the farmer, because I'm looking at a picture at one point in time,
yeah.
Not having a discussion with the farmer of what the situation for that picture is for 12 months of the year.
Mm.
So I would not make a decision on a one-off photo.
So an implementation guide with photos on it would need to be accompanied by an engagement with the farmer to understand on the farm.
Yeah, in theory, yeah. If I was a consultant, that's what I would be looking for.
Do you agree with Federated Farmers' proposition to the extent there's a debate on, I'll ask another question. So in the hill country, and I got told off for saying high country yesterday, in the hill country, do you agree there's unlikely to be significant drains, as that term is understood, as generally?
Yes.
As opposed to down on the plains, particularly in the peat areas where there's much more common drains.
Yeah, drains are generally, as it says in the rules, clear and overland flow away off surfaces, whereas the flow from hilly country is natural.
Yeah.
It follows its natural
flow. And drains, if you look at it, you know, if you drive across the Hauraki Plains, you can see the drains, and there's some very obvious drains
Yeah.
And I know it's in different catchment, but even in the catchment, you can see some areas that are quite clearly drains. And then there'll be some instances of drains that may at one stage have been a water course and got made into a drain. It's perfectly possible, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. I find in my experience as a consultant, things like Google Maps are really good to work out what a drain or a mechanism for moving water is actually being put in there in place for. So you can look to see whether there used to be a river. Is it coming from a spring or another source, or is it actually just collecting overland flow? But generally, no, what you're suggesting is correct.
So do you agree with my proposition then to the extent, and I think you agree that permanent streams is generally a lot easier to understand?
Mm.
Yep. And even ephemeral stream is probably easy to understand or easier to understand. Yeah. So in terms of the two classifications that might be similar, do you agree it would ease the implementation of the plan if the same setback rules applied to both intermittent streams and drains?
The question for me is it would be easy to implement if the rules were a lot more consistent or less rules for somebody to look at. I always think back to, are we achieving the objectives of making those true assessments in terms of risk? Of we're missing a risk on a farm because the rule is not allowing that full assessment.
Yeah, but just to be clear, if intermittent streams and drains were considered the same, then there would be stock excluded. The question would be how much the setback would be. Correct?
Yes, I think so, yeah.
Whereas the national stock exclusion regulations don't require fencing drains, do they?
No.
So this is another example where this plan change is more rigorous, more stringent than the national regulations?
Yes.
Yeah. So, and if the setback was the same for both intermittent streams and drains, a farmer and the council or a certified farm planner wouldn't need to concern themselves with whether it was a drain, intermittent stream, or modified watercourse, would they?
No, as long as it was really clear as to what you're assessing, yeah. It would make it a lot simpler for whoever's doing that assessment.
Great. Thank you very much. Turning now to another topic. Yesterday, just while you got Mr. Cameron's evidence, yesterday, I remember we were talking about the potential need for earthworks for fencing operations, and particularly on the side of streams. And I think we got to the point where, and certainly Dr. Scarsbrook agreed, it wouldn't seem very logical to create more of an environmental risk by doing earthworks than the problem you're trying to solve in terms of sediment. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I do agree with that.
So, and I think in the joint witness statement as well, there's a reference to pinch points, where because of the contour, you might be a spur coming down quite close to a stream, which might mean you can't get the required setback in that particular 5-10 metre stretch of fence line. Was that the sort of thing you're talking about when you're talking about pinch points?
Yeah, and in the discussions that we're talking about pinch points with fencing, you're often wanting to fence in straight lines, because with straight lines you can keep tight fences.
Yeah.
Tight fences last longer and maintain better stock exclusion. And so at points there will be pinch points where there's a compromise to keep a straight line over the size of the setback.
Yeah, I understand that. And then from my client's perspective, who are wanting an average setback and a minimum of one, that would also allow some flexibility in terms of where that alignment was to avoid those pinch points.
It would, but as I discussed earlier, I'm really uncomfortable with a minimum of one setback,
yeah.
And that flexibility is still allowed as long as the minimum is above three at the moment, as the rules are. Right.
Yeah, but the minimum, so if the minimum was above three and you had a pinch point because of a contour or something, you could be required to do some quite significant earthworks in order to take the fence 3 metres away from the stream and still have room to put the fence up, wouldn't you?
potentially, as a farm consultant, when I'm looking at where fences are placed, the first questions I ask are, is what are the objectives and the values of the farmer, and then try to link that to what we're trying to achieve in terms of farming, in terms of riparian planting, aesthetic looks, risk to bank stability, etc., to work out where is an appropriate place for the fence, and often you'll find that's more than the minimum expectation. There's a real risk that when we start to implement actions just to rules, we go just to the rules and we don't look beyond the rules. So that's where I think feel there's a real value of freshwater farm plans or farm environment plans per se, is the fact it allows the ability for that conversation to say, what are we trying to achieve? And then the secondary question is, does that fit within the rules? If not, then we make the adjustment.
Yeah, but flexibility might need to go two ways. There might be situations where you could have very little risk, even with a 1 metre setback, isn't it?
In some situations there could. My experience is it's not very often.
Can I ask you to go to page 10 of Mr. Cameron's evidence? So this is 304.00.00. That's an example of earthworks that were required to put a fence along a stream.
Yes.
To allow sufficient room for the tractor to go along the inside. If that setback from the fence had been greater, there would have had to have been more earthworks, wouldn't there?
In that situation, yes.
And it really does come down to a farm-specific, site-specific, stream-specific analysis.
Definitely. In the case that even with those pictures, I cannot see what the surrounding environment is to make that call as to, well, should the fence line actually be at the top of that hillside? Because the risk on that hillside means that maybe I should be doing some pole planting to reduce risk of a slip. And even with those two pictures, you can't see the full picture as to the decisions you would make on a farm.
Which is the benefit of a certified farm plan, isn't it? You can walk around, get the best place that works. Thank you. Just turning now to the topic of cultivation. And this was dealt with in the joint witness statement. So if I can ask members of the court to have that. So that's the joint witness statement for farm systems. It starts at 401.00.59. And it starts at page 90.401.00.90.
What time is it, sorry?
Is it 401?
401?
Yes.
The right five, did you say, sorry?
Tab 4.
All right, tab 4.
Yeah.
And then the book is, sorry?
Sorry, it's 401 and then page. It's question 37 of your joint book. Okay. So it starts at 401.00.90. You got that? So that's other Schedule C minimum standards of Schedule C9. Do experts agree 5 metre setback cultivation regardless of time or slope? Matters of agreement, no, which is not the most promising start for a joint witness statement. anyway, there apparently was some agreement, which is useful. Just a couple of questions. Cultivation, arable farming generally is not widespread in the Waikato catchment compared to other regions like Canterbury, for example, is it?
Arable farming is in an individual sector, yeah. I would say no, but the process of arable cropping within a dairy farming or dry stock system is, I would say, 80% of farms in the Waikato would put a crop in every year.
Yeah, and that was a point Dr. Lemire made in his evidence, wasn't it? That actually a lot of farms have, and as you say, up to potentially 80% of farms will have some form of cropping.
Yeah.
So it's important to address this correctly in the rules, as
yes.
So the decision's version had a minimum setback of 5 metres for all cultivation activities at any time of the year, on any slide.
Yes.
So a blanket 5 metre setback.
Yep.
And it's possibly an extreme example, but if you turn over the page to 401.0092, the writing is infinitesimally small at the bottom. My understanding is that that was a diagram that was put forward by Dr. Lemire as an example of setbacks that would be required on arable land that had drains in it. Peat land, presumably, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think that's peat farm.
Yeah. He made the point there, I think, that nearly 25 hectares would be lost because of the setbacks from the drains. And is that assuming a 5-metre setback? Do you agree that do you agree that the rules or the restrictions should be relative on a farming activity should be relative to the risk, i.e. the greater the risk, the greater the restriction?
Yes.
And you agree that in certain times of the year there will be a greater risk of runoff contaminant loss from cropping?
Yes.
So winter's bad, I assume?
Winter is generally, you would say, worse, but also the period of establishment and re-establishment of crops is a high-risk period.
Yeah, and slope's also a risk factor?
Yeah.
Were you aware, or are you aware of the proposal put forward by Federated Farmers in terms of a request for some flexibility on that setback?
Yes, we discussed that in the government statement.
Yeah. So, and just to remind you what that was. So that was, in the case of cultivation of land with a slope less than 10 degrees from 1 September to 30 April, within 2 metres of a drain of water body and within 3 metres of any other water body. So the 2 metre setback, if I'm reading this right, 2 metre setback from a drain or intermittent water course, 3 metres from any other water body, i.e. a permanent stream or something.
Yep.
And then at any other time or in any other case, 5 metres. So that goes back to the default position. So what my clients are seeking is some flexibility with a slightly reduced setback on lower slope and drier times.
Yeah.
Which are the less risky times.
Yes.
If the court was minded to come up with or to settle on provisions that appropriately reflected risk at different times of the year, do you think that's a fair provision to both provide some additional land for cultivation but address the risk during the other times of the year by having that default setback of 5 metres?
Yeah, and I indicated that in the joint statement.
So you agree with that proposal?
Yeah, where there was some disagreement, where I said I only partially agree, was what that minimum starting point was going to be, and this comes back to my 1 metre setback. So having been an agriculture contractor and worked lots of hours at night as an 18, 20, 25 year old, you're there to do the job, and I have seen lots of movement of soil that goes directly into ditches, watercourses, because as a machinery travels at speed, it can throw soil up to 2 metres. So as a 18 year old, and probably on the phone, probably not back in my day on the phone, but you're on your phone, actually saying where is my, am I, I'm going to go 1 metre here, 3 metres there, 1 metre there, is not in the mindset of, so it has to be really set out, you know, from the farm, from the consultant to the farmer, to the contractor, then to the contractor's driver as to where those setbacks are going to be, which I would say that is very difficult to implement. So that's why I'm in favour of a general rule that covers those off. I've seen examples even at the weekend going into town on your peat land where a farmer had done his paddock, he'd cultivated, pulled his drain out, he'd cultivated, done the paddock, cultivated back, and he'd thrown soil back into the drain he'd just cleaned out. And because it was domed and there was no lip, and that was the kind of lip that Graham Pennell was talking about, all runoff from that paddock with potential soil was going to go back straight back into the drain.
Thank you. Sorry, I thought I was clear. Now I'm not clear. So do you agree with the rule from an environmental effects perspective but not from an operational perspective, or do you...?
Yeah, I agree that on flatland, 5 metre setback is too much.
Okay.
But...
And it's 2 metre setback on flatland.
I suggested a 3 metre setback, and that's why when 2 was suggested, I was still only partially.
Okay. So you'd agree with 3?
I'd agree with 3.
Okay, just lastly, we had a talk yesterday about setbacks and we've talked about drains this morning. Do you agree it's important for drains to function effectively?
Definitely.
Especially over the last year in the Waikato, I'm sure you
yep.
have seen it.
Yep.
And that not only helps the individual landowner's paddock, but they can have affects upstream as water moves through the catchment to the rivers. And so drains need to be kept clean,
yep.
free of weeds, gorse, blackberry.
Yep.
Do you know, did you read the farm evidence where they explained that having too large setbacks from drains meant it was difficult to get diggers in to be able to clean the drains?
So there would need to be provisions in the rules for if it was a council grant, because there are rules as to what potential setbacks and access needs to be. So, you know, and that's often a discussion that farmers need to have and think about when they're doing their setbacks. So often you will see when there's riparian planting and setbacks that the setback of a on a river or watercourse will be different on both sides, so you can allow access from a digger from one side and not the other, because that's going to be the natural way that the function is going to be carried out. So there's ways around, but I do understand that there are concerns that in cases that people would find access difficult, but that's a bit of planning.
Yeah, and I don't need to go to it, but Mr. Cameron makes that point in his evidence about one side of the drain is narrower than the other,
yeah.
And it avoids the need for long reach diggers, which have other effects on the land, and it's much harder to operate, much more expensive, etc. Have you just seen that?
Potentially, I would agree with them. Again, case by case, you need to know the farms and the contour and the drains that they're looking to. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Thank you for answering those questions. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Mr. Carruthers, are you on the line? Do you have any questions for Mr. Coxhoff? No? I don't have a connection. There she is. Can you hear us?
Lisa, yes, I can.
We can hear you. Do you have any questions for this witness?
I do. Thank you, sir.
And just before you start, there's something going on. Someone may have a microphone on which is bringing through sound. Can I just ask those who are participating on VMR remotely, just make sure if you're not actually participating, your microphone is turned off. We'll see how we go. Go ahead, please, Ms. Carruthers.
Thank you, sir. And before I start, can I just check with the early start time whether you would prefer I pause around 11 for morning tea or go through to 11:30?
I'll be gosh. if you're still going at 11, why don't you pause then?
Okay, thank you. No pressure. Short questions and answers.
Indeed.
Good morning, Mr. Brookstock. I'm going to start by talking about the scope of your evidence. And I may have missed it, but it seemed to me that your evidence was silent on when you'd been engaged by the Regional Council.
Yes.
So would you be able to advise the court as to when you started advising the Regional Council in relation to Plan Change 1?
I was probably engaged 2 months prior to writing evidence.
So relatively, not very long before you started preparing your evidence, is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Okay.
I had an involvement in my previous role with Dairy and Z throughout Plan Change 1 in terms of engagement with dairy farmers and helping to write submissions.
Right. And so you're assisting this court with evidence on behalf of the council as the farm systems expert?
Yes.
And as I understand it, you did not attend the court proceeding held in August last year in relation to Overseer and the alternatives?
No.
Is that correct?
The
statement. Yes. Yeah, and you acknowledge that in your paragraph 43. Now, you did attend the recent caucusing that was held after your evidence was prepared, and I just wanted to check in that joint witness statement, there's a table at the back that says when people left and came back, etc.
Yes.
And that table is on page 51 of the PDF. I'm not sure what page of the bundle, but page 51 of the PDF. And it says there that you left at 4:30 on the 6th of September and did not return. I just wanted to check, did you just miss the last bit of that day, or you didn't come for the other days?
No, just that last bit of that day. Sorry,
okay.
I missed.
Half an hour or whatever. Yeah, okay, cool. So in your paragraph 10, you say that the focus of your evidence is on landowners' ability to manage and reduce contaminant loss from their properties. And then at paragraph 11, you set out what you're not including.
Yes.
Is it correct that you're also not comparing Overseer to the nitrogen risk scorecard? And while in paragraph 43, you record that you agree with the joint witness statement from the conferencing that you did not attend, as I heard your answer to Mr. Minhinnick yesterday, you made it very clear that that was on the assumption that Overseer was not available as an option. Did I hear that correctly?
Yeah, the indication from Regional Council was, as part of my evidence, had received information from MFE that Overseer could not be considered. So I've not included that in my thought processes.
Okay. And then as I read your evidence, you're also not addressing the change in focus and the rules from all farming to just dairy farming with the new use of the nitrogen risk scorecard. That's not something you've covered in your evidence, is it, either?
The my focus of my evidence
so where the rules
was mainly on pastoral farming. So dry stock and dairy.
Dry stock and dairy, okay. And then also what's not covered in your evidence is the removal of the ability to use other decision support tools from Schedule B of Plan Change 1?
Yes.
So if we turn then to what is in your evidence, and I'd like to start in your rebuttal, actually, with this purchase nitrogen surplus issue. And maybe just so we can help orientate the court to the issue, have you got the latest version of the plan change from the council's legal submissions? Do you have that copy with you?
It will be here. Just firstly, can you just direct me to my rebuttal? So
oh, sorry. When I eventually get to your rebuttal, it's going to be paragraphs 53 and 54.
Submission, where would that be?
Well, I'm not sure if that is actually in front of the parties. Yes, thank you. If you printed off a copy that could be put in the witness box.
Yes, this is a clean set. It's got the full legal submissions on the front, but appendix one.
Oh, well, I've got a set here that I printed out, which is just pages 55 onwards to the end, which simply has the cover and registrar. Might just give that. Show that to Mr. Conway and make sure he can verify that that's the current version. And just make sure, Mr. Brock, that you leave that for the next witness.
Okay, I've got the document now.
Right, so if we quickly flick through the rules that start at 3.11.4.1. Schedule C, which my friend Matt took you through in some detail, that's the minimum farming standards that apply in the various rules, but we're interested here in Schedule D1. Now, are you able to confirm to the court that the minimum standards in Schedule D1 are only listed in Rule 3.11.4.3? And so this is a rule that captures dry stock farming and dairy farming.
Yes.
And also actually I think some level of arable, by the way, the rule reference back to, in 3B it also applies to arable cropping. Now, in your evidence in chief, where you discuss Schedule D1, you don't reference
alright, let's just hang on a second, Ms. Carruthers. You seem to have lost contact. Ms. Carruthers, I think you've just gone to D1 and then you froze.
Yeah.
So do you recall your question?
Oh, sorry, I was just turning to D1 when I froze. So
very good.
If we go to Schedule D1, Part D2B, which is over on page
44. So that's diffuse discharge risk requirements.
No. So Schedule D1.
Yes.
Part D.
Yes.
Oh, one, sorry, is the heading, diffuse discharge risk requirements, yes, you're quite right, sir. And then B,
yes.
Annual purchase in surplus shall not exceed 150 kg nitrogen per hectare per year. Now, in your evidence in chief, where you discussed the matters at issue in Schedule D1, Part D, Mr. Brooksop, you didn't discuss the purchase in surplus at that point, but you have addressed it in your rebuttal, and those are the two paragraphs I took you to previously, so 53 and 54. And then there was subsequently a question for the conferencing, and that was question 44 in the joint witness statement. But as I'm reading that statement, this is the one question that you weren't actually in attendance for. Is that correct?
Thank you. From memory, maybe yes.
And so you may not be able to, but if you could have a look at the matters of agreement on question 44 of the joint witness statement. Now, acknowledging that you weren't there for that discussion, but to a non-expert, it's a little bit tricky to work out what they're trying to say there. And I wondered if you'd been in any of the discussion at all, if you're able to cast any light on the answer given in question 44. It's page 37 of that PDF.
So, as far as I was aware, there was discussion on both sides, sorry, as to the value of including the end purchase surplus in the provisions. As you can see, there's some evidence there. There was discussion as that there was no relationship between end purchase surplus and potential leaching, which, from a non-technical side, I would say yes, but what I would say is that there's a potential increase in risk, whether that risk ends up being leaching is a different matter, because there's lots of other circumstances and parameters that influence that. And some evidence was put there to show a general relationship between purchase and surplus and leaching, which was, I believe, the basis of how it is used in the Fonterra scorecard at present. And that was the basis for some of the numbers that were put into the decisions version.
Okay. And so if we could turn back to the standard and back to read yourself the note under the standard.
Yes.
And so that note explains that it's calculated within 12 months of doing the farm plan. So it's not a figure available at the time doing the farm plan, is that correct?
No, but you could, for your own purposes, calculate that for the 12 months previous, for your own purposes to make on-farm decisions, not necessarily to meet the requirements of the plan, but on-farm surplus is something that can be completed by a farmer and is often completed by a farmer to help them to make decisions.
Right, but the explanation as it's drafted says that it's done after the farm plan
yes.
is developed, is that correct? Right. And then the online calculator. Are you aware that that's not yet available?
Yeah, as far as I'm aware, it's not yet available.
And otherwise, a dairy farmer that supplies Fonterra would be able to get this figure from Fonterra. Is that correct?
Yeah. I've not cited directly on the Dairyland website, but I would think there would be a simple spreadsheet that would allow any dairy farmer to calculate that number on their own without the use of their milk supply company.
Right. And what about a dry stock farmer?
A dry stock farmer, there would be nothing on, I believe, on the Beef and Lamb website. What I would say is I don't see this number being too relevant for dry stock, just purely on the average level of inputs that come into a dry stock farm. The input itself will never be above 150. So by the time you've taken off the output, every dry stock farmer is never going to be in a situation that they're going to be anywhere near that level. So in terms of its value in a dry stock situation, it's probably pretty minimal.
Yeah. So as a permitted standard, though, every farmer would need to demonstrate compliance with that standard?
Yeah. And so in the joint witness statement, that's where we discussed that there could be potentially, because there is not too much relevance to dry stock, could mm-hmm. potentially be amended to be for dairy only.
Right. And then for dairy only, does it add anything beyond what is required by the remainder of the standards when applied together?
Could you just expand on the question, please?
Sorry, is there any utility to having it as an additional standard?
If a farmer is looking at data on a yearly basis using the same process to calculate that data, that is always of value because it often shows a trend of direction. So this could be a very useful tool for a farmer to show a trend of direction of my end farm surface is slowly increasing, so I'm potentially having increased risk. Now that's not saying that increased risk is going to cause an increased leaching, because M farm surplus does not take into account biophysical characteristics, soils, climate, etc., the farm management activities. But it's a useful tool to look at that, and that would be a useful number if it's calculated and made available every year to council to help to monitor if there is often what I call system creep within a farm system, and going back to when overseer was there, by taking out overseer, one of my concerns is how do you stop system creep within a rural framework, that by default a farmer increases risk by 2%, 2%, 2%, and in 5 years' time about a 10% increase in system creep. So I was really keen for some of this to stay in there, because this could be a mechanism that would help inform that decision process or of the farmer to be looking at it for the consultant, but also regional council.
And I may have misheard you in that answer, but I think you may have said that one of your concerns was removing overseer. Did I hear that correctly?
Removing a mechanism where on a yearly basis a figure or a risk factor is created. Now the question is, will a scorecard replace that ability to monitor system creep?
And that's where you see the benefit of this 150 kgm per hectare per year fitting into the picture.
Yeah,
In terms of, because there is an expectation to calculate it, we're going to get that number is going to be derived on a yearly basis, which then compared to previous numbers to say, well, has that number gone up because of some climatic conditions? We've had a drought, so I've had to bring in more supplements, but everything else has stayed equal, so as a result, my in-farm surplus has probably gone up. Or is it the fact that I've not just brought in more supplement, I've also increased a stocking rate and a bit of fertiliser, but my output's not gone up as a result. So as a result, I'm actually increasing potential risk.
Yes, and so that's not so much around staying within a maximum, but individual farmers monitoring their trend.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. The number of 150, when looking at how that was derived, is set at a fair, not a high level, but it was at a level that most farmers, and I think the number was, I can't quote me off on
137, I think, you have evidence.
That most farmers should be within that anyway.
Yes. But all this standard requires is that they stay within 150. It's not requiring them to report on trend.
No.
No.
But for me, it's causing a process to take place which will help a farmer to actually realise that, hey, actually I'm increasing risk and maybe I need to think about that, because as I increase risk, I'm actually probably losing money because I'm wasting.
Yeah. Okay. Let's move on then to the mitigations and farm system changes. That paragraph 32 of your evidence and sheet. Paragraph 32 of your evidence and sheet. We say the ability to assess individual farms' inherent and management risk will be an important part of the outcome of this PC1 process. Now, I take from your experience that you set out in paragraph 6 of your evidence and chief that you're probably well across the new freshwater farm land regulations as well. Is that the case?
Yeah.
And that those regulations require farmers to avoid, remedy, or mitigate the risks of adverse effects of farming?
Yes.
Across different land uses on farm?
Yes.
Which is aimed at both the inherent and management risks of farms?
Yes.
Paragraph 38. You talk about farmers needing to make the right decisions on the appropriate mitigation measures and farm system changes. Sorry, I might have gone backwards. At 35, you talk about there being considerable room for improvement in practices. And then at 73, you express confidence that Schedule C minimum farming standards and Schedules D1 and D2 will ensure that actions will be put in place. And there's similar confidence at 132, I think it is. We are meeting these compliance expectations, in particular Schedule C, D1 and D2, will ensure that all farmers contribute to the reduction. I wanted to check, is it your position that if a farmer meets those schedules, that any consent, if required, should be granted.
In terms of schedules, Schedule C?
Yes, because D1's permitted, isn't it? So C and D2.
Yes, yeah. If a farmer, through their farm environment plan, can meet the requirements, yeah, that should be consented.
Okay. So then, just briefly in relation to activity status, which is it? 65, I think. Yes, so this is a whole sort of quandary as to how to identify the riskiest 25%, for want of a better word. In paragraph 65, say, I'm unable to provide any evidence on whether these percentages are appropriate. Are you meaning in terms of whether it's the 25% of riskiest farms, or what's the reference there?
So my understanding when those percentiles were developed through the modelling of PC1 to determine the level of requirements to maintain or reduce contaminant risk through a consenting regime to meet the water quality improvements that PC1 were looking for. So the percentile was based on what we were looking for, improvements in water quality, rather than we were going to use the numbers of the farms to then work it out. So the 70% percentile was there before we even knew the risk of the farms.
Right, and so you're saying here that you don't have any evidence to suggest there's merit in capturing the 25% riskiest farms. The focus should be on water quality generally. So,
no,
is that what you're saying?
I'm saying is that the 75th percentile point was created through the modelling, which was a planning decision, not a farm systems decision.
I see, okay. And so that's why you go on to say that, in your experience, as you increase the number of farms subject to a more onerous classification, you're likely to see greater reductions in contaminant loss.
Now, yes, likely because the risk is greater, so there's more opportunity for assessment and change.
Right, and is that something that the regulations will now be striving for, with the requirement to avoid, remedy, mitigate the risk of adverse effects?
I believe that the process, the planning framework allows that if you are a higher risk farm, there will be more oversight on how the farmer works out what he needs to do to reduce his risk, which will ultimately bring greater reductions.
Right, and so it's that, the level of scrutiny as you work your way through Schedule D2's expectations.
Yeah, I'd like to say that the level of opportunity to work with people to work out how you can do better, how you can change your farm system.
Moving then on to farming. No, I thought we were already there. Sorry, that's a fairly generic topic. In your paragraph 21, you is in terms of the PC1 rules, the land-based enterprises are significant for dairy farming, dry stock farming, horticulture, arable farming and forestry. And then you say forestry is not covered in this evidence and arable farming is not the focus of this evidence.
Yes, in terms of the rules.
Although you do set out, sorry?
Yes, in terms of the rules that may impact them, so in directly.
Okay. And so your evidence doesn't focus in any way on conversion or changing land use. Is that correct?
No. Yes, that's correct, sorry.
Okay. I'd like to turn to the definitions of Plan Change 1, if I could. And I'm doing this purely because I think you're probably best placed to explain these to me, if not to anybody else, but please tell me if that's not the case. If we start with the arable cropping definition, and that's on, so the definitions generally start on page 76 in the glossary.
Yes.
And arable cropping, that's not, the definition there doesn't require those crops to be harvested. Does it? It focuses on the growing of the crop.
As it reads, yeah.
Yeah, okay. And then if we go to dairy cattle, I think that's a fairly well understood definition, as is dairy support cattle. But I confess where I get a little bit confused is in the dry stock farming definition. Now, are you aware there's no definition of dry stock in the National Environmental Standards for Freshwater?
No, I'm not.
Are you aware there's no definition in the stock exclusion regulations?
No, I'm not.
And I haven't been able to find it in the Southland Regional Plan, which I have quite a lot of familiarity with, or the Horizons and Manawatu Whanganui, or actually in any other regional plan. So I'm a little bit floundering here in terms of the dry stock definition, but I had always understood it to generally be non-lactating animals that you were growing for meat, fibre or velvet. But if we can just work our way through this, it seems clear that it's pasture grazing, so stock grazing pasture, beef cattle, dairy support cattle, and then there's a reference to other dairy animals. Is that sheep and goats that are being milked or something else?
I'm unsure. I can...
You're unsure?
Yeah, I'm unsure.
Okay. And so then when it says sheep, goats and deer for meat, fibre or velvet, is it possible that that other dairy animals is intended to be if you're then growing them for meat, fibre or velvet? Or is it a different category altogether?
Again, I'm unsure. There's what you described, or that the dairy animals could indicate dry cows. So our common practice is for a dairy farm to take his cows off to somebody else's dry stock property for 6 to 8 weeks during the winter to spell his own pasture and give it a break, and that provides a valuable income for a dry stock farmer. So it could mean that, but I don't know.
Aren't they dairy support cattle though, those types of cows?
I would class dairy support as the stock that you are growing from a calf or 100 kilos through to getting it back in calf to go back to the dairy farm for its first lactation. after the rearing of a heifer.
Sorry, Ms. Carruthers, just please let the witness finish.
It's a question that's better for Mr. Trebelko.
Okay, sorry for interrupting, but could
you
please look back up at the definition of dairy support cattle, which specifically references ones that have been dried off? Isn't that the exact type you were just discussing?
Yeah, so I stand corrected.
So now that you've read the definition of dairy support cattle, do you have any idea what these dairy animals and dry stock might be?
No.
No, okay. Have you previously looked at the definitions in Plan Change 1?
Yes.
Right, okay. And so then, finally with the definitions, if we go down to farming, which is the grazing of animals, or the growing of produce, etc., and free-range poultry, but does not include the items in A to E. So that's an example where pigs and chickens, llamas, alpacas, all those kind of animals that don't fit into dairy cattle, dairy support cattle, or dry stock. That's where they're captured, isn't it?
I believe so.
And so farming is the broader grazing of animals, not just those specific animals.
Yes. Or includes the broader grazing of animals, yes.
Okay. And so if we just think back to the dry stock farming definition there and its clear statement that it's pasture grazing, am I correctly understanding that for the types of animals listed in that definition, if they're grazing on pasture, they're dry stock, but if they're grazing on one of the crops in the arable cropping definition, they become arable cropping? And if they're grazing on something else, they become farming?
Probably a grey area as to where you would put it in the definition according to when you've got that mixed farming type or when you've got stock that are owned by one person moving on to somebody else's property for a short period to graze. If he was in an arable situation, then he'd put a winter crop in to graze that. So yeah, it's probably a grey area and needs clarification.
But you wouldn't even need to move stock from properties, would you? If sometimes you graze them on pasture, sometimes on lucerne, which would fall into the arable cropping definition, sometimes on something else that isn't in the arable cropping definition, wouldn't your farming go from being dry stock to arable to just general farming under these definitions?
My personal opinion would be no, because that crop is being grown for the sole purpose of providing for that animal within your grazing rotation.
I see. That's how you think the rule should work?
Yeah, because, the same on a dairy farm. If a dairy farmer grows a turnip crop, but he's growing it for the purpose of feeding the animal within the grazing rotation, that doesn't necessarily become, he doesn't necessarily become an arable farmer.
I entirely agree. And so that may be why in the decision version of the rules, they talk about farming under each of these rules, rather than just dairy farming or just dry stock farming.
Yes.
And why having a method of calculating your activities across the farm and working out your risk profile generally with all of your various inputs factored in makes more sense, doesn't it?
For me, it would depend upon the extent of which each of these enterprises are being farmed, and are they being farmed within isolation of each other? So in terms of that, I would say if you had a dry stock animals and dairy animals on the same land parcel, those dry stock animals could be included in the nitrogen scorecard because there's room for that to be put in. But if those, for me, if those two enterprises were being farmed separately, so one was at the back of the farm and one was at the front of the farm and they were not being crossed over, well then you're actually farming two, even though it's in the same land parcel, you're actually farming two different farm types. So it all comes down to that individual situation.
Yes, but the potential difficulty that your same animals and your same enterprise change between definitions depending on what they're grazing on at any one moment seems inefficient.
But there needs to be clarification to make sure that that rule is, or the definitions are simple to understand to allow people to implement the plan.
And so say, for example, if we use as an example rule 3.11.4.4, and if we ignore the tracking, so read what the decision version used to look like. Or I can take you to the decision version in the bundle if that would be easier to understand. You let me know which was this one.
No, I've got the post-conferencing version.
Yeah, and so would it be easier for you? Yes, if you can read what the decision version used to say, we can use that. But otherwise, we can go to the decision version.
No, that's fine.
Okay. So here's... I mean, it's similar throughout the rules, but here, dry stock farming, the winter stocking rate is greater than 18. And then over the page, it used to say, for all other farming, the nitrogen leaching loss rate is moderate. So this was the way of classifying the farming, all of the farming, as a moderate risk activity.
Yes.
Which enabled all of those uses and didn't create the problem that we've just gone through with the definitions. You agree with that?
Totally agree. And that was in the decisions version when it was proposed the use of overseer, which could compare all farms in one file, in one assessment. Because you could include dry stock and dairy in one overseer file across an enterprise or across parcels of land, as long as it was modelled correctly according to the data input standards.
And so when you say overseer there, was it your understanding that overseer was the only tool you could use to generate the nitrogen leaching loss rate?
At the time of the decisions version,
that's my question, yes.
Yeah, when the nitrogen leaching loss rate, I believe the rules may have indicated that
there could have been another tool that was approved by council at the time, but you know, an assumption from a layman was that we were going to use Overseer as the tool.
And just so we're clear, did you see that as a good approach?
The use of Overseer, as it was, in terms of the ability to model a farm, and alongside the accuracy and the challenges that have been highlighted through other reports, it was a good tool that allowed you to collect data, complex data, and put it into a model to generate an output. And then from that output, you could dissect it to look at risk according to sections of that output.
Yeah. Okay, finally then, in terms of, let's start with the arable cropping, so I can check that I understand the council's proposal in terms of these new rule structures. But as I understand it, under Rule 3.11.4.1, so long as you're not using more than 5% of your land for arable cropping, and you have no dairy, and you meet the minimum standards in C, that the cropping is permitted. But given that 5% is so little, it's most likely going to flip into 3.11.4.3, where 3B of that rule specifically allows you to exceed the 5% threshold. And so, provided you still have no dairy on the same property, and you meet Schedule C and D1, then your cropping is permitted. Is that correct?
As I read it, yes.
But as soon as you have dairy on the property, your arable cropping triggers down to controlled activity. Is that correct?
As soon as you have dairy on there, you will need to then create a nitrogen risk scorecard, which will probably be the first measurement that you would indicate what regime you would go into. That would probably override as to whether I'm arable cropping or not. That would be the first thing as
and
a...
So is that
that'd be the first thing as a consultant I would make that assessment for. If I was going onto a property and there was dairy farming, we would calculate the nitrogen risk scorecard first.
Right. And so your arable cropping changes from permitted to controlled as soon as there's dairy farming on the land.
Because technically you're not arable cropping, you're creating supplement for a dairy farm rotation, because the farm is a dairy farm.
Right. And so are you reading into these rules then a predominant use criteria? So you see it as mainly a dairy farm, so it's now a dairy farm.
Yeah, if that crop was one crop in 60 paddocks, 60 paddocks of grass and one paddock was an arable crop, which was going to be fed to those animals, I would see that as a, not as an arable crop, an arable farm, per se.
But doesn't it, under this proposal put forward by the council, isn't it also the case that if you had 85% of the farm in arable cropping in a very small milking platform, control.
I would need to look into how the rules, how you would work out what, how you would assess your risk on that, whether it would be to the nitrogen risk scorecard, because the way you described it, the primary activity now becomes arable cropping, not a dairy farm.
Yeah, well, that might be the appropriate place for the morning tea adjournment, in Your Honour, and the witness can have a look at those rules during the break, if that's acceptable to the court.
Thank you, Ms. Carruthers. I mean, I suppose one of the questions about your hypotheticals is the reality of that, and we might come back to that after the morning adjournment. I mean, certainly if there's a house dairy cow, that probably doesn't tip the whole thing, but there's a reality check, isn't there, about whether somebody would put the infrastructure in needed for a very small dairy herd when, in fact, what they were mainly doing was low-yield cropping.
I agree entirely, sir. Yeah. My issue is with the rules as they're currently set out, linked to the definitions,
well,
and the new notes that the council is now proposing above it. I mean, it's a matter that I can make in submissions.
Well, I do wonder about some of this to do with definitions and so on, and, you know, whether or not the cross-examination of experts about the way in which the definitions may interact would be as useful as trying to say, well, what are the things that need to be defined for the purposes of achieving the objectives? And I, you know, Mr. Matheson has gone through the chaos of the RMA and subordinate legislation's definitions of water bodies, and pointed out that it's extremely difficult for a real person to walk across land and work out what any particular water body is. And I just wonder whether or not we may be doing the same with walking through a farm and trying to work out, is this a cropping farm or is this a stock farm? And if it is stock, what is the purpose of the stock?
Absolutely, sir, which is why the decisions version just used of farming is so much simpler, rather than needing to, but I can get to that after the break.
Well, as I say, it's just a question of whether or not that's ultimately a matter for submission rather than a matter for evidence.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Right. Back in 15 minutes. Thank you.